Chapter 2. Most thoughtless, these creatures have the same elements and capacities of goodness as yourselves. They are molded in the same form, and made of the same clay, and though 10 times worse than you, may, in having retained anything of their original nature amidst the trials and distresses of their condition, be really 10 times better. I believe that to do this is to pursue a worthy, and not useless vocation. Gentlemen, that you think so too, your fervent greeting sufficiently assures me. That this feeling is alive in the old world as well as in the new, no man should know better than I, who have found such wide and ready sympathy in my own dear land. That in expressing it, we are but treading in the steps of those great master spirits who have gone before. We know by reference to all the bright examples in our literature, from Shakespeare downward. There is one other point connected with the labors, if I may call them, so, that you hold in such generous esteem, to which I cannot help adverting. I cannot help expressing the delight, the more than happiness it was to me to find so strong an interest awakened on this side of the water, in favor of that little heroine of mine, to whom your president has made allusion, who died in her youth. I had letters about that child, in England, from the dwellers in log houses among the morasses, and swamps, and densest forests, and deep solitudes of the far west. Many a sturdy hand, hard with the axe and spade, and browned by the summer sun, has taken up the pen, and written to me a little history of domestic joy or sorrow, always coupled, I am proud to say, with something of interest in that little tale, or some comfort or happiness derived from it, and my correspondent has always addressed me, not as a writer of books for sale, resident some 4,000 or 5,000 miles away, but as a friend to whom he might freely impart the joys and sorrows of his own fireside. Many a mother, I could reckon them now by dozens, not by units, has done the like, and has told me, how she lost such a child at such a time, and where she lay buried, and how good she was, and how, in this or that respect, she resembles Nell. I do assure you that no circumstance of my life has given me 1/100th part of the gratification I have derived from this source. I was wavering at the time, whether or not to wind up my clock, 3, and come and see this country, and this decided me. I felt as if it were a positive duty, as if I were bound, to pack up my clothes, and come and see my friends, and even now I have such an odd sensation in connection with these things, that you have no chance of spoiling me. I feel as though we were agreeing, as indeed we are, if we substitute for fictitious characters the classes from which they are drawn about third parties, in whom we had a common interest. At every new act of kindness on your part, I say to myself, that's for Oliver. I should not wonder if that was meant for Smike. I have no doubt that is intended for Nell. And so I become a much happier, certainly, but a more sober and retiring man than ever I was before. Gentlemen, talking of my friends in America brings me back, naturally and of course, to you. Coming back to you, and being thereby reminded of the pleasure we have in store in hearing the gentlemen who sit about me, I arrive by the easiest, though not by the shortest course in the world, at the end of what I have to say. But before I sit down, there is one topic on which I am desirous to lay particular stress. It has, or should have, a strong interest for us all, since to its literature every country must look for one great means of refining and improving its people, and one great source of national pride and honor. You have in America great writers who will live in all time, and are as familiar to our lips as household words. Deriving, as they all do in a greater or less degree, in their several walks, their inspiration from the stupendous country that gave them birth, they diffuse a better knowledge of it, and a higher love for it, all over the civilized world. I take leave to say, in the presence of some of those gentlemen, that I hope the time is not far distant when they, in America, will receive of right some substantial profit and return in England from their labors. And when we, in England, shall receive some substantial profit and return in America for ours. Pray do not misunderstand me. securing to myself from day to day the means of an honorable subsistence. I would rather have the affectionate regard of my fellow men, than I would have heaps and mines of gold. But the two things do not seem to me incompatible. They cannot be, for nothing good is incompatible with justice. There must be an international arrangement in this respect. England has done her part, and I am confident that the time is not far distant when America will do hers. It becomes the character of a great country, firstly, because it is justice, secondly, because without it, you never can have, and keep, a literature of your own. Gentlemen, I thank you with feelings of gratitude, such as are not often awakened, and can never be expressed. As I understand it to be the pleasant custom here to finish with a toast, I would beg to give you America and England, and may they never have any division but the Atlantic between them. Speech. February 7, 1842. Gentlemen, to say that I thank you for the earnest manner in which you have drunk the toast just now so eloquently proposed to you, to say that I give you back your kind wishes and good feelings with more than compound interest, and that I feel how dumb and powerless the best acknowledgments would be beside such genial hospitality as yours, is nothing. To say that in this winter season, flowers have sprung up in every footstep's length of the path which has brought me here, that no country ever smiled more pleasantly than yours has smiled on me, and that I have rarely looked upon a brighter summer prospect than that which lies before me now, for, is nothing. But it is something to be no stranger in a strange place to feel, sitting at a board for the first time, the ease and affection of an old guest, and to be at once on such intimate terms with the family, as to have a homely, genuine interest in its every member. It is, I say, something to be in this novel and happy frame of mind. And, as it is of your creation, and owes its being to you, I have no reluctance in urging it as a reason why, in addressing you, I should not so much consult the form and fashion of my speech, as I should employ that universal language of the heart, which you, and such as you, best teach, and best can understand. Gentlemen, in that universal language common to you in America, and to us in England, as that younger mother tongue, which, by the means of, and through the happy union of our two great countries, shall be spoken ages hence, by land and sea, over the wide surface of the globe, I thank you. I had occasion to say the other night in Boston, as I have more than once had occasion to remark before, that it is not easy for an author to speak of his own books. If the task be a difficult one at any time, its difficulty, certainly, is not diminished when a frequent recurrence to the same theme has left one nothing new to say. Still, I feel that, in a company like this, and especially after what has been said by the President, that I ought not to pass lightly over those labors of love, which, if they had no other merit, have been the happy means of bringing us together. It has been often observed that you cannot judge of an author's personal character from his writings. It may be that you cannot. I think it very likely, for many reasons, that you cannot. But, at least, a reader will rise from the perusal of a book with some defined and tangible idea of the writer's moral creed and broad purposes, if he has any at all, and it is probable enough that he may like to have this idea confirmed from the author's lips, or dissipated by his explanation. Gentlemen, my moral creed, which is a very wide and comprehensive one, and includes all sects and parties, is very easily summed up. I have faith, and I wish to diffuse faith in the existence, yes, of beautiful things, even in those conditions of society which are so degenerate, degraded, and forlorn, that, at first sight, it would seem as though they could not be described. But by a strange and terrible reversal of the words of Scripture, God said, "Let there be light," and there was none. I take it that we are born, and that we hold our sympathies, hopes, and energies in trust for the many, and not for the few. That we cannot hold in too strong a light of disgust and contempt, before the view of others, all meanness, falsehood, cruelty and oppression of every grade and kind. Above all, that nothing is high, because it is in a high place, and that nothing is low, because it is in a low one. This is the lesson taught us in the great book of nature. This is the lesson which may be read, alike in the bright track of the stars, and in the moldy course of the poorest thing, that drags its tiny length upon the ground. This is the lesson ever uppermost in the thoughts of that inspired man, who tells us, that there are tongues in the trees, books in the running brooks, sermons in stones, and good in everything. Gentlemen, keeping these objects steadily before me, I am at no loss to refer your favor and your generous hospitality back to the right source. While I know, on the one hand, that if, instead of being what it is, this were a land of tyranny and wrong, I should care very little for your smiles or frowns, so I am sure upon the other, that if, instead of being what I am, I were the greatest genius that ever trod the earth, and had diverted myself for the oppression and degradation of mankind, you would despise and reject me. I hope you will, whenever, through such means, I give you the opportunity. Trust me, that, whenever you give me the like occasion, I will return the compliment with interest. Gentlemen, as I have no secrets from you, in the spirit of confidence you have engendered between us, and as I have made a kind of compact with myself, that I never will, while I remain in America, omit an opportunity of referring to a topic in which I, and all others of my class on both sides of the water, are equally interested. There is no difference between us. I would beg leave to whisper in your ear two words. International copyright. I use them in no sordid sense, believe me, and those who know me best know that. For myself, I would rather that my children, coming after me, trudged in the mud, and knew by the general feeling of society that their father was beloved, and had been of some use, than I would have them ride in their carriages, and know by their banker's books that he was rich. But I do not see, I confess, why one should be obliged to make the choice, or why fame, besides playing that delightful reveal for which she is so justly celebrated, should not blow out of her trumpet a few notes of a different kind from those with which she has hitherto contented herself. It was well observed the other night by a beautiful speaker, whose words went to the heart of every man who heard him, that, if there had existed any law in this respect, Scott might not have sunk beneath the mighty pressure on his brain, but might have lived to add new creatures of his fancy to the crowd which swarm about you in your summer walks, and gather round your winter evening hearths. As I listened to his words, there came back, fresh upon me, that touching scene in the great man's life, when he lay upon his couch, surrounded by his family, and listened, for the last time, to the rippling of the river he had so well loved, over its stony bed. I pictured him to myself, faint, wan, dying, crushed both in mind and body by his honorable struggle, and hovering round him the phantoms of his own imagination: Waverly, Ravenswood, Johnny Deans, Rob Roy, Caleb Balderstone, Dominie Sampson, all the familiar throng with Cavaliers, and Puritans, and Highland chiefs innumerable overflowing the chamber, and fading away in the dim distance beyond. I pictured them, fresh from traversing the world, and hanging down their heads in shame and sorrow, that, from all those lands into which they had carried gladness, instruction, and delight for millions, they brought him not one friendly hand, to help to raise him from that sad, sad bed. No, nor brought him from that land in which his own language was spoken, and in every house and hut, of which his own books were read in his own tongue, one grateful dollar piece to buy a garland for his grave. Oh, if every man who goes from here, as many do, to look upon that tomb in Dryburgh Abbey, would but remember this, and bring the recollection home. Gentlemen, I thank you again, and once again, and many times to that. You have given me a new reason for remembering this day, which is already one of mark in my calendar, it being my birthday, and you have given those who are nearest and dearest to me a new reason for recollecting it with pride and interest. heaven knows that, although I should grow ever so gray, I shall need nothing to remind me of this epoch in my life. But I am glad to think that from this time you are inseparably connected with every recurrence of this day, and that on its periodical return, I shall always, in imagination, have the unfading pleasure of entertaining you as my guests, in return for the gratification you have afforded me tonight. Speech. New York, February 18, 1842.
At a dinner presided over by Washington Irving, when nearly 800 of the most distinguished citizens of New York were present, Charles Dickens, the literary guest of the nation, having been proffered as a sentiment by the chairman, Mr. Dickens rose, and spoke as follows.
Gentlemen, I don't know how to thank you, I really don't know how. You would naturally suppose that my former experience would have given me this power, and that the difficulties in my way would have been diminished. But I assure you the fact is exactly the reverse, and I have completely balked the ancient proverb that a rolling stone gathers no moss, and in my progress to this city I have collected such a weight of obligations and acknowledgement, I have picked up such an enormous mass of fresh moss at every point, and was so struck by the brilliant scenes of Monday night, that I thought I could never by any possibility grow any bigger. I have made, continually, new accumulations to such an extent, that I am compelled to stand still, and can roll no more. Gentlemen, we learn from the authorities, that, when fairy stories, or balls, or rolls of thread, stopped of their own accord as I do not it presaged some great catastrophe near at hand. The precedent holds good in this case. When I have remembered the short time I have before me to spend in this land of mighty interests, and the poor opportunity I can at best have of acquiring a knowledge of, and forming an acquaintance with it, I have felt it almost a duty to decline the honors you so generously heap upon me, and pass more quietly among you. For Argus himself, though he had but one mouth for his 100 eyes, would have found the reception of a public entertainment once a week too much for his greatest activity. And, as I would lose no scrap of the rich instruction, and the delightful knowledge which meet me on every hand, and already I have gleaned a great deal from your hospitals and common jails, I have resolved to take up my staff, and go my way rejoicing, and for the future, to shake hands with America, not at parties but at home. And, therefore, gentlemen, I say tonight, with a full heart, and an honest purpose, and grateful feelings, that I bear, and shall ever bear, a deep sense of your kind, your affectionate and your noble greeting, which it is utterly impossible to convey in words. No European sky without, and no cheerful home or well-warmed room within shall ever shut out this land from my vision. I shall often hear your words of welcome in my quiet room, and oftenest when most quiet, and shall see your faces in the blazing fire. If I should live to grow old, the scenes of this and other evenings will shine as brightly to my dull eyes 50 years hence as now, and the honors you bestow upon me shall be well remembered, and paid back in my undying love, and honest endeavors for the good of my race. Gentlemen, one other word with reference to this first person singular, and then I shall close. I came here in an open, honest, and confiding spirit, if ever man did, and because I felt a deep sympathy in your land. Had I felt otherwise, I should have kept away. As I came here, and am here, without the least admixture of 100th part of 1 grain of base alloy, without one feeling of unworthy reference to self in any respect, I claim, in regard to the past, for the last time, my right in reason, in truth, and in Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.